Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone. Times of transition and change can often be difficult for anyone, and especially so for someone who has or currently is struggling with an eating disorder. One of the most life-changing events for someone can be starting college, especially if that involves moving away from home for the first time. So if you're a student with a history of an eating disorder or currently struggling with one and are about to enter college or even in college right now, this is a podcast that I think will really give you some important things to consider. And similarly, for any parents or loved ones of students who has or is struggling right now, I think this is a great episode to listen to. Now, for me, it's been some time since I've worked at a college counseling center, but I do remember all too well the anxieties and the high prevalence rate of eating disorders that the students have, especially for those of the incoming class. But our guest here today can definitely provide much more information and firsthand knowledge about the college population. Ayanna Phillips is the founder of Lotus Counseling. After a decade of working at the University of Michigan, other university settings, as well as private practice and Ann Arbor DBT Center, she decided to provide services solely at Lotus Counseling. In addition to general mental health, she specializes in all eating disorders and body image concerns, substance abuse and chemical addictions, compulsive behaviors, and anxiety concerns. Prior to relocating to Ann Arbor for her position of senior staff clinician and coordinator of alcohol and other drugs at the University of Michigan, she began her clinical training journey at the Ohio State University Counseling and Consultation Services, as well as addiction treatment centers, Talbot Hall and Mary Haven. Her work includes specialty groups such as Division I athletes. Well, Ayanna, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you here.
Hi, I am so happy to be here. Always great to chat with colleagues who do the, you know, same or similar work. So happy to be here. Thank you.
You know, I think it's great timing right now, what we're going to talk about. And I'm imagining there's people out there listening who are going, oh, thank you for talking about this right now, because, you know, next month is the month where a lot of students are going to find out where they're going to go to college, where their acceptance, where they're going to get accepted. And so I'm actually wondering, like in your realm of the world, you know, we're in different, you know, parts of the country. What's going on for you and your work? And what are you seeing? What are you seeing with the families and the people you're working with?
Yeah, I will tell you that for us, the busiest time of year is like mid-August, right, when the new school year starts. And we have a lot of students who are sort of very prepared, who have been in therapy before. We're calling in, I want to arrange a provider. I mean, some of them actually call in June and July, and at that point, we're usually not scheduling that far out. But, you know, so we do have families and students who are very honored, want to be set with providers in the recovery world. I mean, I'm such a believer of having the team on board. So, you know, non-diet dietitian or eating disorder recovery dietitian, physician, and a therapist. So, I mean, good for them, because if you call us mid-September, we probably have a wait list, and it's going to be much more difficult. So I really appreciate that. But, you know, the anxiety is certainly in the air. And, you know, I'm on the University of Michigan campus, and for years, number one presenting concern always has been anxiety. So we have a pretty anxious campus as is. But certainly if you're also coming in with a history of an eating disorder, right, there are other elements to it. We're really fortunate. So even though I no longer work at the counseling center there, my practice is within walking distance. And so I always say we kind of have a counseling center away from the counseling center, if you will. But we are really fortunate, because even the docs at the Student Health Center have actually eating disorder team. And I think that that can be rare. You know, it's really wonderful when we can all be on the same page. We're looking at the same blood work and same progress goals. And, you know, it really, really helps. But sometimes it's not enough.
That is so, I love hearing that. So I worked at before. I feel like I've had all these different experiences. So I worked at here in California, Cal State. It's called East Bay now. It used to be Cal State Hayward. I'm aging myself now. And University of Hawaii in their counseling centers. And one of the biggest things, to your point, that I saw with, you know, new students was the anxiety, the transition, but also the eating disorder stuff. And there wasn't that dedicated team. So I'm really excited to hear that there's an eating disorder team on campus there, because I think it's something that is really needed. And I don't know, just because you maybe have more knowledge or awareness, is that something that a lot of campuses have now for students?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the other campus that I worked at was at Ohio State. And I mean, Ohio State had an eating disorder program within the hospital system. So I suppose it was still available. I don't know. I don't know how other campuses compare. I mean, I think, you know, UNCG has UNC, right? Chapel Hill has a pretty strong presence in terms of eating disorder recovery. So I think it probably depends, right? How big the school is and where you are at. You know, if we can get folks there, we will find providers in a community for sure. But it's very essential. And I know, you know, right, at least at this time of recording is, you know, we're approaching March. And that's, as you said, right, students are going to be finding out where they are going. And mm-hmm. I know folks, you know, evaluate a lot of different factors. But for some, this can be one of those factors, right? We also have a really strong recovery program for substance use and addictions. So, you know, there are plenty of students who are choosing schools based on what's available for recovery. And I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, for anyone listening, maybe they're thinking, okay, so maybe it's not a big deal. Why are we talking about this? Why is it important to think about, you know, work so hard to get into college? It's exciting. Like, why should I even be thinking like, what's the big deal about like thinking about if there's help for my eating disorder for my child, maybe if parents listening for my child, if there's help for their eating disorder once they get to college and university?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that certainly folks who have been in recovery, I think the families usually appreciate the importance of it because they certainly don't want a relapse and the kid having to have to withdraw from school, right? But maybe this would be more relevant for folks who are maybe teetering, maybe it's been disordered eating, maybe they have not been in active recovery, and or even for folks who haven't encountered eating disorders. I mean, the truth is, right, that a lot of folks still will encounter an eating disorder for the first time in college. And it's because there's so many darn transitions happening, especially the first 6 to 12 months. There's so much to navigate, right? I mean, we get kids who are pretty independent, but some kids have never done a load of laundry or cooked a meal for themselves, right? So there's like so much to navigate. And even dining halls have come a long way. And you know, resources are different in many schools, but it's still a ton to navigate aside from just even social pressure and rigorous academics. And it's just different. You know, I think our students love the newfound freedom, if you will, but it also comes with this other side of it.
Yeah. And, you know, talked about this on here before, but maybe people who don't understand, it's a lot about control. The purpose of the eating disorder, and with so many transitions and changes that can oftentimes spark eating disorder behaviors, because it's the one thing you can control is your food, or the sense of, oh, I can control my weight. I can control it's the number on the scale. I can control the number of minutes I exercise. It's like all the eating disorder behaviors become this thing, you know, it's like, I can control all of this because my environment's out of control. My feelings are out of control. Like everything feels so overwhelming. This is the one thing that, okay, especially if you've had an eating disorder before, it can, to your point, rear its ugly head again, like, okay, I'm going to go back to the thing that felt safe or the thing that I felt I could do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One of those coping strategies, right? Maladaptive long-term, but seemingly effective in a moment. I mean, if it even temporarily helps your anxiety, it makes sense that it's here. But the unfortunate thing is that it becomes compulsive and obviously not workable long term, but it makes sense. And ton of pressure, right? So we have a spring break at Michigan this week, and some of our students went abroad, and you hear the conversations like, I'm going to Spain and I'm going with all of my friends and no one eats breakfast. What is that going to look like for me, right? So that certainly can show up in the Greek system or any situation where you have roommates and housemates, and you get to see what people do, what kind of habits they have, and the pressure is very much on. Of course, we have dealt for so long with the nonsense of fresh 15 and, you know, coming to college already terrified what that will look like. And self-care can be lacking. You know, I think students get a good hang of it eventually, but I always say as the semester goes on, we see such increase in distress, right? Like, we know, like, if you didn't tell me what time of year it is, I will tell you what time of the year it is, because we can tell when finals are approaching, the distress is just accelerating. And that's a time where I just want to sort of go on campus and like wrap them in, you know, a bunch of food and comfort things. But they're, you know, they have to manage, get through it, and then they usually go on break. But yeah, a lot to navigate.
You know, I want to go back to what you said. I think that's really important, not just for students, but in general. There's that codependent nature with people who have eating disorders of like, I'm going to do what everyone else is doing. You don't want to be the outlier or the person that's doing something different. Mm-hmm. And so if being in a group of people, I hear this so often, like, oh, if nobody else is eating, I don't want to eat. Or if they're eating this, even if I'm more hungry, I'm not going to eat that. And so someone who's maybe still trying to stick to like a meal plan or trying to stick to eating, you know, in certain, you know, every couple, 2-3 hours or whatever they're still trying to do for themselves, that's part of their treatment plan, say, or just following their hunger signals, right? I'm hungry. I want to eat. But everyone's like, I'm not hungry. Let's wait. Or they're not eating for hours. Like, for anyone listening, like, how can they kind of navigate that or advocate for themselves and not feel like they're sticking out like a sore thumb?
Yeah, you know, it's such a common theme for eating disorders in all kinds of ways. And one of the things that I tend to tell my clients pretty frequently is stay in your lane. You gotta focus on your lane. I understand exactly what you said, right? It's difficult when everyone around you, or seemingly. I'd also remember I do a lot of RODBT as well, and we see the world sort of through our own lens, not necessarily how it is, right? And so it's gonna be colored as well. But if I can sort of impart one truth here, so you've got to stay in your lane. It certainly helps if you can disclose recovery or your efforts to folks that really you trust and are good supports, that's your plan. It's really the same. Campuses are sort of, can be really hostile environment for substance abuse recovery as well, right? Mm-hmm. And there are parties everywhere, but you can, one, find your people, and two, you can absolutely disclose and say, listen, I'm not drinking. I would really appreciate if you could support me this way or that way. I understand that there's often shame around it, and, you know, not everyone is a close support. But I think, you know, even in therapy, we role play, we prepare, because students might say, oh, I'll handle it, right? But then it comes to it, and the pressure is coming left and right. It really is helpful to role play this and prepare for it, much like athletes do when they prepare for their race. You know, there's a lot to be said about sort of that exposure and prep and coping ahead. And, you know, at the same time, right, it's a bit of a balance. So if we have someone in recovery with eating disorders who wants to go also super prepared into that study abroad or the vacation with friends, right, we also don't want them to be so rigid, right? So it's that balance of like, can you have a backup? Can you have maybe some snacks? Can you have some plan, right, that you eat every 3 to 4 hours, whatnot? But also allow yourself to really experience the culture and the food, right? That's sort of part of the experience. So it's not easy. It takes some planning and it takes decisiveness. And you know, I do a lot of values work with people, right? And so the gremlins and these other thoughts will be distracting you, saying, well, she's not eating, he ate less than you. But we still got to keep driving that bus of the direction that we want to pursue in our life, right? And sort of unapologetically. And I think that we still have some ways to go for people to to be able to shake that. And as you know, some of our clients are already very hypervigilant of, you know, have social anxiety, are hypervigilant of being observed, even when they are not observed. So there are a lot of elements that go into it for sure.
Yeah. So go into that a little bit, because that's something, you know, and I work with this all the time. People are so convinced that everyone's looking at them, or, well, if I'm looking at other people, people must be looking at me and evaluating me. And to your point, like, kind of working with people about that, and you know, of course, in your new environment and you don't know anybody, feeling very insecure and kind of self-conscious about everything, you know, your parents, what you're eating, all of that. How much are you seeing that right now with the students?
Yeah, absolutely. And it certainly was just social anxiety, and it certainly was eating issues, right? But I think the irony of, number one, oftentimes we are so wrapped up in our own stories and our own heads. I don't really pay attention to what's happening around me all that much, right? Like, people think that I'm observing you on the street and whatnot. So sometimes I say, just don't give yourself that much credit. People really don't care that much. But the truth is that this can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if I am deep in my eating disorder and behaviors show up, then it's quite obvious. It would be hard to hide. The problem is, right, that I'm also fueling my anxiety, because now I'm worried that people are observing me. I may subsequently go back to behaviors even more. So it can become a little bit of a vicious cycle. And that's a little bit of the put your blinders on and mind your plate. Because even if we go with straight DBT and check the facts, I don't know what she ate for breakfast or dinner, what her life is, what her medical situation, I don't know. So it doesn't really matter what's on her plate. Easier said than done, right? But these are some of the mantras that we just have to keep in mind and keep on repeat, even if we don't believe it. I mean, sometimes you have to do the behaviors in order to change the emotion and change the cognitions, right? So and our ODBT does a great job of a lot of exposure to that. Do it even if it scares you. Do it even if it's uncomfortable. Certainly in therapy, you can unpack what that looked like and do chain analysis on that and sort of what precipitates what. But the bottom line, if nothing else, do it even if it scares you, you know, do it even if it feels awkward.
So people might be listening going, what did she just say? What's RODBT? Like, what's chain analysis? Can you kind of, just a quick overview. I know it's really kind of complex.
Absolutely. And thank you, because I can certainly slip into, you know, tech language, right? Technical words, psych babble, psychobabble, if I sometimes call it. So dialectical behavioral therapy does a lot with emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and interpersonal effectiveness, which we also see is so important in eating disorder recovery, right? How we now communicate. We don't have to communicate through an eating disorder. How do we become effective? All of that. Our ODBT is radically open dialectical behavioral therapy, and we find it helpful, especially with folks who are on the restrictive end of things, so more anorexia nervosa. We know sort of from the psychological profile, right, that there are, like, folks with anorexia tend to be restricted in other ways as well. So socially restricted. This could be money, sex, food, right? You name it. And so radically open is actually pursuing things that are important to you despite the anxiety, the proclivity to be more hypervigilant, more perfectionistic, more sort of risk averse, right? So RODBT really adds that element of more exposure for that particular profile, if you will. I feel like there was another question you were asking me, and I don't know if I answered it.
No, just because I think sometimes people hear things, you know, saying like something like chain analysis and going, what is that?
Yeah. So chain analysis is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it basically unpacks, right? So sometimes folks come to us and say, oh, it just kind of happened out of the blue. I don't know why at XYZ behavior. But the truth is nothing happens out of the blue, right? And so we will go sometimes 72 hours, even more back, right, to see what your eating looked like, what kinds of behaviors were present, maybe were you drinking, or was there a precipitating event, maybe a fight with your partner. And then we unpack really step by step the thoughts, the behaviors, and basically how did we get here? Because nothing really happens out of the blue. So chain analysis is a strategy from dialectical behavioral therapy, and very, very effective. And certainly, you know, it can be easier for folks with behavior, with more the sort of like bulimia nervosa, right? But we can do it on any of the disorders on the spectrum of eating issues.
Because, I mean, I get constantly asked, you know, what's the best treatment? What do I do? So people maybe who've never heard of this are going, well, wait, I heard CBT, cognitive behavioral therapies, mm-hmm. like what I should be seeking. And now maybe they're going, wait a minute, maybe I need to seek that. And, you know, for anyone who's confused out there, listen, like there's a variety of different techniques that work for different people. So don't think like, oh, that's the best one. I got to do this. I've been doing the wrong treatment. I mean, I don't know your opinion on that, but I personally feel like you got to find the best fit for like when I'm working with somebody, the best techniques and the best things for each individual. But I don't know your thoughts on things.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I will say, you know, I'm pretty behaviorally oriented, but I will still say that people heal when they feel heard. And so we cannot underestimate the role of the therapeutic relationship and the connection with the provider. That said, because eating disorders can be so darn sneaky, we need some behavioral markers, because it would be negligent of us to just kind of, yes, I have a great relationship with you, and also you're not making any progress, and that would be negligent, right? So, yeah, you're absolutely right. We know, you know, CBT can be really effective, specifically eating disorder, focused CBT, DBT has been out there. We even know IFS, right? And of course, with the folks who are still at home with parents, I'm a big fan of FBT because, you know, the parents can have a lot of power. And actually, even in college, I believe in behavioral contracts, because some of my students, you know, sometimes wonder like, who should I involve in my care? And I'm worried that they're going to overstep, they're going to monitor me too much. But then it again creates a little bit of the self-fulfilling prophecy, because when the family has no idea at all what's going on in your recovery, what should they go by? Now, there are some situations in families where we don't advise that families involve. Absolutely. And that's where the individualized treatment planning comes into play. But I also think that eating disorders, I mean, if we had cancer, right, let's not forget, eating disorders can be fatal. If we had cancer, would we want to do it alone? We don't want to do it alone. Right. And supports can be great allies. And it's good. I mean, if you look at anorexia and osteonosha, right, like anosognosia, where people don't actually know just how sick they are, you really want these supports to be involved. And listen, even from the business world, right, I believe in contracts. They kind of protect both sides. And even though contracts are made to be broken, at least we know where it was broken or what's not working, right? So I believe in behavioral agreements as well. But that's a lot of talking for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, it, like you said, it's individual to everybody, because I was just going back in my head thinking about, you know, students I've worked with, some the contracts were great. Some they did much better when they left home, because some of the major triggers were in their families of origin. So to your point, like it was better to not have the families involved. Some felt extreme anxiety coming back for like the first break, which is often like Thanksgiving break, because they were thinking, oh my gosh, like I'm back where all the triggers are. And now this is a holiday revolving around food, and felt a lot of pressure to look a certain way, getting comments about their appearance from families and things like that. So it can get very complicated.
Yeah. I'm so glad you bring that up, because it can be loaded. And we often plan for that, right? How will you navigate it? How will you set boundaries? Who will be or who can be your allies when you do go home? Mm-hmm. But again, right, a lot of it can come. Listen, we may not, if there's a lot of dieting and diet culture at home and all of that, we will probably not change it overnight, if ever. Mm-hmm. And so it's like that student in, you know, substance abuse recovery, they're going home, there's a bunch of drinking. What will you do? That plan is really important. But sometimes families are willing to do their work, right? And work on their diet mentality and, you know, are interested in helping. And actually, when we do DBT with teens, the families are involved. Like they are basically doing, right, the treatment side by side. So everyone is learning coping skills. So it's not just on the person. But I'm so glad that you brought that up, because it can be a hostile environment in that sense. Returning home, like you said, holidays, food, diet talk, conflict, right? Sometimes there's even abuse. So we definitely have to take it one by one.
Yeah, because I didn't want to just make it sound like just transitioning to college, university is like always this big stressful triggering thing. It can be actually very beneficial sometimes.
Some of our students will say like, it's almost like if you've grown up in these four walls, that's all you know. And then you go to college and you suddenly hear different stories and you realize, oh, it doesn't have to be really this way. And sometimes we have students who stay on campus, right? They have better supports there. Although around holidays, it can be a bit lonely. Michigan, though, has because we have a lot of international students, they don't necessarily travel for Thanksgiving. So we still have programming around that time. So yeah, again, it depends, right?
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious too, I don't know if you know much about like the Greek system, but you know, I've often heard there's a lot, especially with the females, like diet talk, people dieting together, this kind of thing. I'm wondering if you have much of an awareness of what's going on with the Greek system, and if like girls are tending to come to you and say like, there's a lot of diet talk, I'm getting triggered. They have typically cooks in the sorority houses and things like that. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah. there is so much opportunity. So University of Michigan also does a bunch of programming for the Greek system, for Greek life, again, substances, eating disorders, all of that. But there's a lot of social pressure. There is a lot of perfectionism, competitiveness. So these are pretty, it's a fertile ground for something like that. And you're right. I have had even students who will say, my house mom was commenting on what I'm eating for breakfast, right? Like, are you going to eat that? So, it can be tricky. We have wonderful educators, health educators on our campus, but we have ways to go. We've come a long way and we still have ways to go. Oftentimes the Greek system leaders are part of recovery efforts as well. So it just, right, again, it depends. But and I think that's where students have to evaluate for themselves, right? Like, is this the environment for me? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, sometimes just like we hear, if we need someone to go into treatment, right? Like, they're really struggling. They're clearly not thriving by any stretch of the imagination. It's really hard to convince them to go into treatment, right? Because it feels like if I take a semester off, that feels like forever and I will lose my supports. Or maybe if it's engineering or nursing program, then that, you know, I have to wait for the classes a whole year. So I get it. I get that it's a sort of like a big deal, or leaving sorority, you know, it seems like I'm paying these dues and that has been my support. What am I going to do? Where am I going to rebuild? But I promise people do find new supports that really help their recovery. People do leave campus, people leave student organizations, and some not, right? I have a student who comes to mind who I saw in undergrad, and she wasn't ready. She just wasn't ready to tackle her eating disorder, willing, you know, I always say willing, able, ready, right? But returned to me in her PhD program and said, you know, the one thing that I wish is that I could have done recovery sooner, because I kind of white knuckled through undergrad. Oftentimes brilliant students, right? Great grades, all of that, but not much social life. So anyways, I could go on and on this.
Yeah. I mean, so for someone who's kind of contemplating, maybe they are kind of on the cusp of, you know, not sure of how am I going to handle food or my eating disorder, like maybe they're still really active in treatment and they're going to move away to school. Like, are there some things you would suggest asking themselves in terms of if they're ready to actually go away the first semester or quarter, or putting it off, postponing it? Because I know that can feel very scary, daunting, or maybe like, you know, oh gosh, if I don't start with my class and move into the dorms, I'm going to miss out. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know I've had a podcast earlier on discussing this one thing, but I'm just curious, you know, for parents questioning that too, like, I'm really scared to send my child off. I don't think they're well enough. I'm really scared they're going to like go full blown back in. What are some things people can consider?
Excellent question. And I think that some folks are not going to like to hear what I have to say on this. I really, ideally, your child would go when they're ready, meaning do they have at least 3 to 6 months behavior free under their belt? Doesn't mean they cannot relapse, but if they're struggling with symptoms, why send them? It's not going to improve under pressure. That is not where it's going to get better, right? So that is my short answer. If you are thinking, you know, and so that's a sort of like, that may feel like an all or nothing. It's for now. I think that we need to remember it's just for now. It's just for now. And here's why, as you and I both know, treating anything chronic is so much more difficult. Not only are there some irreversible results of that, but also we have a much harder time getting it under wraps, right? And so this is your chance. Like I wouldn't hesitate if the kid was sort of struggling, pull them out. I know that that's not going to be the favorite or popular option, but they can return, let's say 3 months later, 6 months later, and really give it their all rather than just sort of surviving, white knuckling and having mediocre, if any, social support, you know? So I would look at that. Now, if it's a little bit like, I feel like they have done decent in recovery, I think they can do it, we have lined up really solid support, then I think the contract comes handy, right? Where you clearly outline, like, what are the markers that will tell us, no, we need to pull this back? Mm-hmm. You know, are they willing to do regular therapy session? Are they willing to do regular dietitian session? What are the markers? I think that we can try to bury our head in the sand, but, you know, that usually doesn't work really well, right? So don't be afraid to outline. And I actually think, again, right, even the students become hypervigilant because they then wonder, like, is my mother, like, what is she thinking? She's probably thinking I'm not doing enough in recovery. When you have it outlined, I don't think anyone then has to guess. You know, I actually think that it's good for both sides. Again, if the family can be involved in treatment, right?
You know, I'm just thinking personal experience myself, like hiding everything because it's like, you know, it's the own nothing. Like I have to, you know, put on the good face, the perfectionism, like I'm fine, right? Like lying about it because it's so shameful and embarrassing, like not wanting to admit there's relapse or that you're engaging in anything, right? Complete, just like, I'm good, you know? Like, because how awful would that be to have to admit, like, I can't hack it. Oh, you know, I'm fine. Because what does that look like? That's very scary to be like, oh, I need to drop out or I need help.
There, I would be so curious to know what changed it for you. And I'm thinking to myself also, there's so much strength in saying so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And acknowledging that. And then ultimately also, who cares? I know that's easier said than done. but like, that's your life. And you know, if we were to be so reductionist, I mean, we're only as sick as our deepest secret, right? Like there's something to be said about this sort of having to have to hide and live hypervigilant. And I mean, it's just, I think it's heartbreaking and it doesn't have to be that way. But I'm so curious to see sort of what turned it around for you.
Yeah, because I mean, I think I was the typical, like I talk on here, right? It's like, no one's going to know because I'm getting the straight A's and I'm doing all this. And on the outside, everything looks rosy, right? And that's why I'm a big advocate too. I say on here, like, you are as sick as your secrets. Once there's so much relief when you're just like here, bleh, you know, it's like the balloon pops and you're just like, you know, well, and I've shared on here too, like there was this moment, right, where like, I couldn't just deny it anymore. Like I had this moment where I just passed out and I ended up in the ER and, you know, it was like a big, huge wake up call. Like at some point there's the day of reckoning, right? Like, okay, I can't hide anymore. Like my body's giving up, right? I have to figure this out.
Yeah. And there's like a blessing and a curse of like, right, you being so talented and intelligent, you can hack the academics for a long time and all of that, but there's just so much more to life than just that, right? And I think it becomes so isolating. Mm-hmm. Right? Like we have to be vulnerable. I'm going to pull in Brené Brown. You can't make connections without vulnerability and people, you know, and also we can relate to perfection, right? Like mm-hmm. It's hard to connect with. And there are even studies like if I'm coming across anxious, I'm making others anxious, right? And then my students become so isolated, like sometimes surprised that they're not invited to parties.
Yeah.
or dinners, right? Because they know they can make a decision about their dinner and such. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just I think that's the hard part too. To your point, you're isolating because, oh, I can't eat that, or I don't want to eat that, or food's not going to be there that I can eat, or it's scary, or, you know, even getting dressed, when there's nothing to wear, it's scary to put on clothes, or just, you know, all the social anxiety stuff you were talking about too, right? Or needing to fit in workout instead of going out with your friends, or just all of it, right?
Yeah. And we have to remember, right, that avoidance begets avoidance. Mm-hmm. So it just becomes bigger and bigger, and slowly but surely takes over your life. So I'm curious, you know, if you were to look back, like, is there anything that people around you could have done differently?
No, it is interesting too. I had, this was a bit strange to think how many episodes I've had on now, but I did have one of my colleagues who was a previous friend of mine in college give feedback on the podcast, saying like, we all knew, like, you know, you know, we knew, like, if we're hanging out with you, like, we'd have to work out with you, right, doing a weekend, like, it was, we all knew, but you didn't know, like, that. It was interesting to hear the feedback after I was recovered from people, and was like, oh, I wasn't hiding anything, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly that. I hear that often, and I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure, even though I haven't talked to your roommates, that they know.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes it's really quite obvious in behaviors.
Yeah. So just that's another thing to my point, is like, there is the freedom in opening up, because you're not hiding as much as you think you are.
Yeah. And people could actually help. I mean, not that, right. I mean, it's not up to our roommates to be our therapists or anything like that. But I think even just having that support and connection can do a lot.
Yeah. But the other thing too is, how supportive are schools if a student does want to say it's mid-semester and they're like, look, I'm really sick, they want to withdraw and go on medical leave? People might be scared. Oh my gosh, I'm going to lose all this tuition. I'm going to lose my credits. I'm going to be so far behind. I just got to push through the last like 3-4 weeks. Like,
yeah. So I can only speak for Michigan, but usually you can withdraw on medical grounds quite late into the semester. So I wouldn't worry about that. And I suppose, I mean, I don't take this lightly. I know that some students are on scholarships and loans or financial aid, but again, it's a small drop in a bucket when you think of it sort of as a big scheme of things, right? And I don't know. I mean, I suppose if you have 4 weeks left in a semester, maybe you can keep white knuckling it. Not if your heart rate goes so darn low, you would need to seek immediate medical attention, right? So it depends. But then what I find, the students will say, you know, I can do another 4 weeks to finish the semester, and then still, right? And then it's another semester. And it just, we just keep finding sort of reasons for why not to enter treatment. And yet, the folks that come back from treatment, and again, this could be even substance use or, you know, anything else, like folks who need treatment, when they return, it's night and day. It's night and day how they show up, you know, and how they can really live the college life. And not that that's sort of a magic cure of everything, but it, night and day is just all that comes to my mind. You know, we just see it. I wish that people would enter more often. At U of M, we also have actually funds for even treatment. We have, you know, specific sort of like emergent. This doesn't mean that every student can sort of have the top-notch residential treatment paid for. It is often finance-based, right? Like financial need-based. But let's say we're sending them for a nutritionist in the community. A nutritionist doesn't take insurance or something like that. You know, the school can come up with some money to pay for that. So, you know, oftentimes there are actually more resources than people think. That withdrawal can be a lot easier than we thought. You know, academic advisors, our dean of students office is incredibly instrumental. And in fact, we do have a sort of a committee for students in crisis. So sometimes students with a severe eating disorders may end up on the radar already. Now, that's a tricky subject, because schools have for so long tried to navigate what would be a criteria that we would mandate treatment. And sometimes it's BMI, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about BMI. I talk about it publicly on socials and all of that. But, you know, it's hard for them, right? Certainly if someone is failing medical exam, and we so know that eating disorders, we can show up so resilient, right? And one day you seem to be okay, and next day you fall over with a heart attack on a treadmill. So it's so difficult with eating disorders, right?
Yeah.
So schools struggle with when they actually mandate you leave for treatment. Mm. And I hope that it doesn't come to that, but know that Dean of Students Office and other departments can be your ally.
I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I think there's this perception that there are so many barriers to treatment. And yes, there are, which, you know, that frustrates me to no end. But it is good to know that if people do need resources or support, that they are out there, that there are becoming, I think there's becoming more awareness about mental health and illness too, which is promising. You know, fingers crossed that keeps going, but...
Exactly. And that more insurance companies cover treatment and particularly residential, right? But even for that, we sometimes find scholarships for folks, right? Even sort of independent of the school, some treatment places have scholarships. So, yeah.
And one thing I do want to touch on too is I think people forget that eating disorders are, they do, unfortunately, you know, people do die from them, but also, you know, college students are also prone to depression. And if you have a student who's got an eating disorder and depression, you know, they're much more susceptible to dying from suicide. And I think that's something that, you know, not to be glossed over, because you can become very depressed if you're, you know, away and maybe isolating and not with friends. And so it's important to really screen for depression too.
Yeah, for sure. And we know, right, like the more the brain is malnourished, the higher the chances of that, right? So we can die of eating disorders simply because of the physical impact, but certainly the emotional, mental health impact, such as depression, like you said. But we also know that when we re-nourish the brain, sometimes depression and anxiety can go away. So, you know, it depends, right? For some folks, it's what chicken or the egg, what was here first. Right. But I can absolutely say that for many folks, these symptoms improve once we re-nourish the brain. Mm-hmm. And I think what we often forget, right, that the malnourished brain doesn't just show up in anorexia. I mean, it can very much show up in binge eating disorder. It can show up in bulimia. So we cannot take that lightly, you know, how much it impacts the brain for sure.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up in terms of like re-nourishing the brain. Because to your point, like having a team of providers, a psychiatrist, a therapist, a nutritionist, I mean, it takes a team approach, and also medical doctor to manage the physical aspects of things too.
That's right. Your heart rate, right? Your bone health, all of it.
Right. So very complex illnesses.
For sure. Yeah. And also, right, like I do this work. I love this work because when my eating disorder clients are some of the most brilliant, most creative folks, very in tune, oftentimes highly sensitive folks, right? But it's like when they are recovering, like some of them are writers and just creators. And so like, yeah, it's also wonderful to see when recovery happens and people can really flourish.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I have seen people like completely different when they're refed and they're re-nourished and they've been eating, and it's like they are alive. I mean, they're talking and they're laughing. And I mean, it's like they're a whole different like personality and person. And it's like, wow, right? Like, this is great. Because it does, it kind of like, you lose yourself. You kind of don't have the energy to even think or to laugh or to feel. I mean, and I know that's part of the coping mechanism, right? You don't want to feel or think or whatever. But it is so amazing. You regain your life back.
Exactly. And I mean, really with in recovery, sometimes folks are really rediscovering what they like, right? They have forgotten sometimes, what do I actually like? And so we'll send them on adventures, you know, do you like Starbucks or do you like Roost Road, another coffee shop here? And so, you know, we start exploring, and and seeing what sort of makes them happy. And I'm so glad you're bringing up sort of becoming more alive and full of life, right? Because that also, you get back from that. Because right, people interact with you differently then also.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're more approachable, and not everyone is going to be your friend, but you kind of find your people as well, you know, what truly resonates. And so that's what the eating disorder recovery is all about, right? Going back to our inner voice, whether it's trusting that we know what to eat, when to eat. I mean, if, you know, there are exceptions to that, restoring hunger, satiety cues, and all that, but also just trusting, right, that you know who your people are and what really you're passionate about. And yeah, that's all it is. That's sort of the main thread here, right? Like, let's go back to your inner voice. It was here at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten lost along the way. We can get back to it.
Yeah, oh, great. Now you've talked a lot about so many things, very important things. If people want to work with you or find out more about the work you do, how can they find you?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, I'm still limited to working with folks in therapy just in the state of Michigan because of licensing regulations. So that I'm the founder at Lotus Consulting in Ann Arbor. We have about 30 providers. Not all of us do eating disorder work, but certainly all of us do college mental health. So that's, again, Lotus Consulting in Ann Arbor. And I also have a separate resource, and that's for parents and caregivers of kids with eating disorders, just under IlonaPhillips.com. I have a course there for caregivers who are just sort of trying to figure out the roadmap of how I help my kid with an eating disorder. I also have a membership there. So those would be two places.
No, that is so needed. I'm so glad you do that. I will definitely send parents your way. I get those questions all the time. So that's fantastic. Any last final words before we end?
I think we have run over a lot of different things. I will just say that even though I can only do therapy in Michigan, I am always happy to answer questions. So if folks have questions about treatment and, you know, I'm happy. Please don't hesitate to reach out.
That's fantastic. Thank you again so very much. And thank you for all the work you're doing.
Absolutely. Same to you, and have a great day.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guest are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.